So again, good morning. My name is Joyce Moy. I'm the Executive Director of the Asian American Asian Research Institute, also known as ARI. And I'd like to welcome all of you today to our conference on building coalitions and coalescing Pan-Asian Pacific American identity. Let me just start off by saying that I'd really like to thank my staff. Everyone knows Anthony Wong, I'm sure, William Tam and Zhu Wu. Also love to thank some of our other great contributors to this. An intern by the name of Claire Chun in particular was very instrumental in the thinking and organizing of this event, as well as thank all of our speakers, our panelists, and our moderators today. And special thanks to Eric Tang for his contributions, to Paul Watanabe, and as well to others. What caused us to put this program together has been an observation of all of the things that have been happening in the last several years. It is clear that there is a need to create coalitions to address issues that have a particular impact on our community. We have heard over and over again that the Asian American population in this region has doubled over the last 10, 20 years. We also recognize that the Asian American community today is different than the Asian American community 20 years ago in New York City. We come from different parts of the world. We speak different languages. The diversity is immense. And it's imperative that we talk about how we can come together when needed and even before it's needed to make sure that our interests are represented. It is imperative that we come together and look at how we hold the line and not allow the advances that our community has made over the last century to be eroded by the changes that are coming down the pike. And then it is imperative that we find our way to the tables where the policies that impact our lives are being discussed, so that our voices are represented. And it is imperative that we move an agenda forward, that we reach out to other members of our community, that we get to know one another. There are times when, because of a narrow lens on issues that are particularly too important to us at that particular time in our lives, that we forget the context in which our communities exist. We forget that we have to forge alliances with those outside our own communities, whether it is within our own Asian American community or with other communities of color. And we've got to revisit those issues and make sure that we forge the alliances that are necessary so that, again, we do not allow our rights, the opportunities for our young, to erode. And also so that we can march together, shoulder to shoulder, to make sure that this country lives up to the promise that it runs around the world telling everybody it has. We have to be sure that we can hold people accountable. And that's what today's discussion is about. How do we reach out across our communities, create coalitions, build an infrastructure, not come together only when there are emergencies, but to build an infrastructure so that we can move forward? And so again, thank you all for coming. At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Paul Watanabe from UMass Boston. And the title of his comments today is Contested Transformations, Trump, Asian Americans, and the Challenge of Change. Thank you.
Thank you. After that, I feel like I'm giving the second keynote address. It's like the warm-up act overshadows the main act. I want to give my thanks to Joyce and her staff for organizing this. I've come to this event actually on my own several times in the past, and I always come away learning something from you folks here in New York, which applies to people around the country and certainly in my hometown of Boston. Let me begin by setting the context for my broader remarks. And the context is one in which we've gone through a period of great transformations in this country. For example, believe it or not, it wasn't that long ago when we had the great transformation of the election of the first person of color to the presidency of the United States, a tremendous change which brought along with it even overstated notions about, you know, a post-racial America and so forth, a significant transformation. But we've seen and we're experiencing a broader transformation right now, and we're experiencing it with great rapidity and dynamism within the United States. And that's in the changing demographics of this country. As my biography points out, I've been the chair until recently of the U.S. Census Bureau's National Advisory Committee on Racial, Ethnic, and Other Populations. And one of the things that we've done is try to predict when this country will become a majority non-white country. And I think our latest prediction is probably around 2043, and it's probably even going to come before then. That's a significant reality that we're moving to quickly. Just think about this. This is a country that will, which has been dominated, overwhelmingly dominated, even today is overwhelmingly dominated by white Americans. But within a very short period of time, within 25 years, by the time people sitting in this room, you young adults, for example, will be having grandchildren and children of your own, this country will be a majority non-white nation. And that majority non-white nationhood is being driven by more than anything else, immigration, and immigration from diverse sectors of the world, from the Western Hemisphere, from Asia, and partially from Africa as well. So the question is, what is going to be the response to these transformations? Are we going to embrace them? Are we going to resist them? And my point is, in my title, is I think that these transformations have not been easily accepted, and they have been vigorously contested. Think, for example, about the Obama presidency, and I think it's very clear this kind of resistance that he felt from the very beginning from Republican leadership, who vowed not to do anything to support this particular president. I think less because of what he stood for and more because of what he was and what he represented in terms of the kind of leadership that we have traditionally had within this country. Think about the response by the birthers who questioned where he was born, about those who questioned his Christian religion, about the increase in hate group activity when Obama became president, about the increase in gun purchases when Obama became president, and of course, most recently, the election of Donald Trump. And I'll have much more to say about this, which I think very directly is a part of the contestation of this transformation, a response to the Obama phenomenon. And of course, even Michelle Obama, if you've been reading the papers lately, have been targeted. She was commenting recently on the Trump administration's decision to roll back school lunch nutritional standards. And Michelle Obama, in response, stated this way. I'm going to try to turn this a little. I feel like I'm aiming to that person and nobody else, but we'll see if I can pull this off. Thank you. She stated in response, "Moms, think about this. Take me out of the equation. Like me, don't like me, but think about why someone is okay with your kids eating crap." Now, of course, most of the comments was their use of her word crap. But I think what's really behind this is, of course, that Michelle Obama and other people of color can't be taken out of the equation. Because by doing so, you have to be taking race out of the equation. And race is what is at the heart of the resistance to Obama and to the larger changes, the transformations that I'm talking about that are taking place in the United States. In terms of that larger transformation, think about the rallying cries of the Trump forces. Take back our country, our country. Not the country that I'm talking about that's evolving. A return to a country that is predominantly white, a country that doesn't reflect the diversity that exists at all levels within society. Taking back our country, not the country that's evolving. And of course, the notion of make America great again. The notion is taking back our country not only from Obama, but from the larger transformation and the forces that are part of it. It is rejecting change by looking to an idealized past, a past, in my view, that has never existed. America has never been fully great ever, as long as we've been burdened, as we have from the very beginning, by our racial problem, our racial dilemmas, and our continuing racial dilemmas. We cannot talk about American greatness. We can only talk about the hope of American greatness. But for them, the idea is returning to a period of time when America was once great, an America once when there was clear dominance about who was in charge, a desire to return once again to a country that does not reflect the diversity that I believe it's necessary for us to embrace. All of this notion, all of this contested resistance reflects status anxieties, people's position changing within society, the dominance of various groups based principally on color being challenged to some degree, fear, scapegoating for people's problems, and of course, underlying it all is fundamental racism. I think it may be overstated, but I think Bill Maher sort of had it correct a little bit when he said the Tea Party doesn't like two things. One, they don't like being called racist, and two, they don't like people of color. In some ways, behind that resistance, and I understand the economic dislocations that are part of it, to me, the most fundamental part is racial resistance. Now, what are the actions and consequences of the resistance to change? Well, of course, this is affiliated with the Trump ascendancy. And we've seen that ascendancy reflected. A lot of people said, where have we seen the changes? We're seeing on a daily basis in terms of personnel and policies that are destructive to the world which I want to create and which I think your children want to live in. We've seen it not only in enabling and emboldening those who take views that are opposed to eliminating discrimination and oppression and prejudice. In almost every sector of American government at the federal level now, we've seen steps taken back, not just Muslim bans and so forth, not just limitations on what we're doing, but in education and in health, in terms of support for programs that support the poor within the American society and within people of color. We're seeing significant steps taking back. When you cut programs that affect the environment, when you deny that we're having environmental change, the ability to respond to those environmental damages, the ability to sustain themselves and resist, those abilities are obviously, are very much to a large degree economically determined. The ability to respond to disaster of any kind, economic, climate, and other words, are economically derived. And the poor communities will have a less resistance to doing so, responding to those situations. And across the board, we're pulling the rug out from under these particular communities. So policies have been at the heart of this. But of course, there's been the enabling and the emboldening of those who want to resist change and oppose the changes that we talk about. The Southern Poverty Law Center recently came out with a report that described 2016 as, quote, an unprecedented year for hate, an unprecedented year for hate, measured by rise in hate groups. And in the 2 weeks after Trump was election, they recorded 1,000 bias-related incidents across the country in a two-week period. We've seen this impact on college campuses. I'm a college professor, so let me talk about my own. We've seen fear almost immediately among students. Our DACA students, for example, are a good example of the fear that the Trump age has brought. And I'm happy to say that our campus has tried to respond to this. In fact, just 2 days ago, I went to a special celebration for our DACA students for graduation, a special celebration held for them that was attended by all of the people that attend graduation, from the chancellor to the deputy chancellor to the provost to all of the deans. This is our way of showing support for these students on our campus. But they're experiencing fear. They're experiencing concern. Immigrants in generally, particularly Muslim immigrants, are feeling this, and Arab immigrants are feeling this as well. And this is imperative on our campus and on all campuses that have these populations to provide for counseling and protection and support, and Know Your Rights sessions and so forth directed at this particular population. We have set up special counseling sessions from January 20th, the day Trump became elected, inaugurated as president of the United States. We began to have special counseling sessions during the new term for students who felt that they were being threatened, perhaps, and fearful because of what the new government might bring to them. And, of course, it creates all kinds of dilemmas. If you think, for example, about the DACA population, many of us activists, one of the things that we tried to do is tell DACA students that they should register and continue to re-register under DACA when President Obama provided the protections for those students. Now we wonder whether we should, in fact, have those students register and come out and come out of the shadows, because they are admitting to this government that they now do exist, that they have records now, that, and it's not clear what kind of use that information will be put to by this government. So it's create real dilemmas for those of us who, under the Obama police policies on DACA, felt that we encourage people to come out of the shadows to report and to register and re-register as is required under DACA. Now we're wondering whether to ask these people to come out of the shadows because they may be threatened by the information that they now give to this government. We've seen a targeting and recruitment, ironically, on our campus of students by the alt-right and white nationalists. If you Google UMass Boston and the alt-right and nationalist recruiting, you'll see that it's precisely on campuses like ours, which are considered fairly liberal, progressive campuses that have large numbers of immigrant and non-white students. We have a majority of immigrant of non-white students on our campus, that the alt-right and the white nationalists are trying to recruit. And this is something very real which is taking place in terms of college campuses as well. We've seen surveillance of faculty and students. One of the professors, Andrew Leung, an immigration scholar, had his class on immigration policy surreptitiously taped by an alt-right group. And if you probably Google Andrew Leung and his class, you'll probably see the tape that was kept, that was taken about his lecture on immigration policy and used by the alt-right to argue that American college professors are arguing for a United States of America that is opposed to the interests of whites within the United States. So we've seen an increase of this sort of surveillance of faculty and targeting of students. And we've seen challenges to racial and ethnic studies programs. Hunter is not the only campus in America facing resistance. But I must say, given its location, given Hunter's location, its history, and its makeup, it is perhaps the most shameful case, I think, of administrative resistance that at least I'm aware of. I've been following the Hunter case for almost a decade, and it is beyond my ability to understand how that administration can continue to oppose the establishment not only of some program, but a vigorous program of Asian American studies in New York City. It deprives the city of an important resource. It deprives the students of something meaningful for them, because I know the value of these programs for those students and for the communities that they come from. And, of course, another side of contention is the census. As I've mentioned before, I played a heavy role in trying to work on the census. And it's interesting, when I began first working on the census, most of the advocacy came from the progressive forces, if you will, who were arguing for greater and greater granular data, more data on more people at a lower level. This was the constant push for us, to get more data about more groups, about more variables at a smaller level. Because the idea is people wanted to see themselves in the census and valued the idea of disaggregated information as much as possible, particularly on groups like the Asian American community, which is so diverse. One of the changes that I've seen in the last 5 years or so is the advocacy has been balanced on the other side by strong advocacy from what I'll call conservative forces, right-wing forces, who have argued that the Census Bureau should not be taking data on racial and ethnic groups. There are those who have argued that the census should simply be focused on what it is constitutionally required to do, which is every 10 years do a count of the population for portions of reapportionment and redistricting, to not take information about the ethnic and racial makeup of the United States, and to deny funding to do outreach to communities in preparation for the census, to make things like the ACS, the American Community Service, voluntary, and to not include and to reduce significantly the budget of the Census Bureau. That is the form of resistance, I think, to the change, because the resistance is, because the change is being chronicled by the census. And it's not simply a matter of wanting to know who individuals are. Lives can depend upon the existence of disaggregated data. It's important to know about the health and situation, not only about large groups, but significant parts of diverse ethnic groups within those large collections. And so this is important, an important fight that we're having. But I must say, I'm holding my breath, for example, because in preparation for the 2020 census, traditionally the census questionnaire has to go in front of Congress. Now, almost always Congress has simply said, okay, checked it off and given a nod and said you can ask the questions during the 2020 census. If you remember last time, it was 10 questions, 10 minutes. That's all it was for the decennial census. I'm concerned this time that an activist Congress, particularly a right-wing activist conference, may take a close look at the kinds of questions that we're asking within the census, particularly around issues involving race. So that's once again another battleground, an area of resistance to even chronicling the change that I've been talking about. Now, of course, we've seen transformations in Asian America. It has been growing, yes, but the question is, at the same time, are we growing but also growing together, or are we growing apart? This is what in some ways you'll be focusing on for the rest of the day here at this conference. Diversity complicates things, particularly when it comes to Asian Americans. As a story I like to tell, and maybe George Takei has told the story to many of you, George Takei was talking about when they decided to start this series called Star Trek, that he and the producer Gene Roddenberry got together, and Gene Roddenberry wanted to do something really innovative, which is create a program that was dominated by people of color, all people of color, and placing them in leadership roles, not just in terms of servants and nannies and people taking care of white children and so forth. So he wanted to place them in roles of significance, and he wanted to have an Asian role as part of the Starship Enterprise. But his dilemma was this: what would you name this person who's an Asian on the ship? If you named them Wong, they would represent somebody who was likely Chinese. If you named them something Ito's, likely somebody who was Japanese. If you named them something Nguyen, somebody who was Vietnamese, and so forth. So how to get a name that responds to the diversity that we have within Asian America? And so Gene Roddenberry went over and looked at a map of Asia, and there in the center of Asia was a sea. It was called the Sea of Sulu, or the Sulu Sea. And he said, that's it, Sulu. Sulu sounds Asian, but it doesn't sound Indian, it doesn't sound Vietnamese, it doesn't sound Korean, it doesn't sound Chinese, it doesn't sound Japanese. And thus the name Sulu derived. Many of you who work on pan-Asian efforts, I'm sure you've gone through this dilemma as my research institute has. What kind of a logo do we have which captures the diversity of Asian Americans? You know, I guess we've tried all the waves that we can do, banyan trees, rice plants, all sorts of things. We've never really been able to come up with something which captures the diversity within Asian Americans. So that complicates our dilemma, the transformation in Asian America and the composition of Asian American at various levels. We have individual ethnic identities and attachments amongst Asian Americans, and those are centrifugal forces. Those are forces that in some ways help to separate us from each other. And yet we have shared identities, shared experiences, shared destinies. Those are part of the centripetal forces that pull us together despite our many differences. Now, I would argue that shared treatment suggests shared destinies. That in some ways, while we are different in terms of where we came from, and as Joyce rightly points out, I hate it when people say, tell me something about Asian culture. I don't know what the hell Asian culture is. Even someone once told me about the Asian language. Like there's this universal language that all Asians speak no matter where they come from. We understand the diversity and the history and experiences. We understand even the conflicts between the countries from which we come from, which we see to this very day. But in some ways, it's a little too short-handed. But while we are in some ways are divided by where we came from and our histories abroad to a considerable degree, we are united by experience here in the United States. That's why the American part of Asian America does really have meaning. There is a difference between being Chinese and Japanese or Indian or Vietnamese or Indonesian. And there's something about the difference between that and being Asian American, between Chinese American, Japanese American. There's something that within our experience, within our treatment, within our destinies here within the United States that unites us together. Asian American is a powerful political identity, minimally. It's a powerful political identity. We may have different cultural identities, we may have different social identities, but as a political identity with all of the political uses of it, Asian Americans is powerful. It gives Asian Americans communities, all of them, the individual communities and the broader communities, size and weight. And size and weight are important in terms of organizing, advocacy, and having political power within our communities. Today you will be addressing the status of Pan-Asian Americanism here in New York and around the nation. Perhaps I think this notion may be a false dichotomy between the choice between Pan-Asian Americanism and individual Asian identities. Because I believe that strong Chinese American, strong Korean American, Indian American, Vietnamese American communities, so forth, are the basis for having a strong, united Asian American community. That there's no reason why we can't have strong individual communities and strong organizations that serve them. And they don't need to be something that is in juxtaposition to having strong Pan-Asian structures. Indeed, I think they can be the foundation for having effective Pan-Asian structures. They can be the significant basis for having strong Pan-Asian coalitions within Asian American, amongst Asian American organizations, and more importantly, coalitions and even stronger alliances with communities of color beyond Asian Americans, with the communities of color that are going to make up the new majority within less than a quarter of a century. In other words, unity, difference can coexist with unity for Asian Americans. Indeed, I think strong differences can be the basis for having a stronger, broader community. That's my hope. That's my belief. But there must, however, be shared and uncompromising commitments to core values as we do this. Anti-racism, protection of civil rights and liberties, tolerance, diversity, inclusion, real equity. We must tear down the walls, not building them up. We must be tearing down walls, not building them up. We must tear down walls between Asian Americans and other groups and within the great and growing Asian American community. Thank you very much. A rebuttal or question or two, if people have them. Yes, sir. I think there's a mic right by you. Is that right?
Yes. There's a mic just behind you. Step up to the mic. Please identify yourself.
Okay. So I'm Naveen Singh. I work at Bronx Community College as an assistant professor. I'm originally from Madhes, which is a part of Nepal.
Yep.
By origin, I'm Indian. The things that you have mentioned, you know, it all has some kind of historical and as well as social, economic, and cultural, you know, you can say the roots. And if we go back, we also see this kind of, you know, the pressure for building a coalition is always, you know, in one form or another. But in reality, we also, as you mentioned in your presentation, that we very often try to identify ourselves as Indian American or, you know, Chinese American or Korean mm-hmm. American or Japanese American. We don't try to have, you know, a whole identity, the things that you are referring to, you know, the Asian American. And this is, I think, particularly also, we haven't able to reach out across our own communities, and there is not, you know, any, we can say so far, a leader who can have a trust across the communities.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you see that is a kind of the problem? So, yes, we have a need, you know, to form, you know, the coalition, form a different kind of, you know, the unity. And that's the reason I think we have to think about is we have diversity, but we can also be united. So diversity in unity, unity in diversity. That's, I think, is a kind of required, which is...
Yeah, I agree with you in this notion that you don't, you know, you can have more than one identity. And those identities can be operationalized in different ways for different things. You know, certain of you may celebrate Tet New Year. Others of you may celebrate Chinese New Year. My tradition, Japanese, celebrates New Year on January 1st. So you can do all of those things, but you can also maintain as well an Asian American identity. And I say, and they don't need to be at war with each other. I grew up in the West where Japanese Americans like myself were a fairly large group. I came back to school to go to school in Boston, and I couldn't find another Japanese American to save me. And the ones that I met were from Philadelphia, who are a different even breed of Japanese American. But in my long experience, I've now been almost, geez, how many years have I been? I've been over 40 years in Boston, where there's not a large Japanese American community. But I've been involved in the Asian American community. And I must say, being identified and working with the Asian American community has made me a stronger, more confirmed Japanese American. I haven't lost my identity as a Japanese American and my attachment to it, but I've gained something. I've gained something in terms of broader reach and understanding and comrades, frankly. And I've gained something in terms of understanding. And even some degree, even if I didn't want to do that, even if a lot of Asian Americans want to recede and not identify themselves, let me tell you the structure that occurs in, at least in, around my place. Whenever an Asian American opens up a business, a convenience store or something in the suburbs of Boston, I will tell you this, within 2 weeks, somebody's going to come and scrawl, "Go home, gook," or "Get out of the neighborhood, gook." And it's going to apply whether that business is started by a Korean American, a Chinese American, a Japanese American, a Vietnamese American, whoever. In some ways, even if we wanted to lift and free ourselves from this reality, in some ways the dominant culture puts us in that box anyway. And I'm saying if they're going to put us in this box, let's deliver, let's accept it, let's build upon it, let's resist from it. You know, part of the problem, and I wasn't able to get into it in part of my speech, is we people of color have to get over the notion of looking at the idea of power through the eyes of white ascendancy and white supremacy. Why does white have to be the norm anymore when we look at it? We always talk about why aren't we winning, people of color. Well, the question, we have the numbers. The question is, should be, why are we losing? There shouldn't be a reason why, if you look at an analysis based upon even numbers, other than this notion that the white is the norm, white is the way, white is what we want to ascend ourselves to. And too many of us, I think, are going to be open to this idea of co-optation. I don't know if many of you read Herbert Gans's piece in the New York Times last week. Herbert Gans's piece in the New York Times essentially said this: white people, you don't have to worry about this change that I talked about, that is the dominance of non-white people, because a lot of white people within the United States are going to co-opt parts of the non-white groups. They're going to bring them into the fold. So white people don't have to worry about this transformation is taking place. Well, to me, I think co-optation is resistance to the reality that I'm talking about. And you're going to, if you're willing to be co-opted, if you're willing to be utilized in that place, you're once again reaffirming the notion of white power as the norm to which we all need to adjust and hopefully aspire to. You know, for me, we're in Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. I mean, I'm going to get booze for this, but wouldn't it be wonderful if one time we can reach a reality in which we have White American Heritage Month, that we place them in their particular category rather than to disaggregate and silo and balkanize all of the other groups of color?
Thank you, Doctor. My name is Edward Ma. I'm a psychotherapist. I was a human rights commissioner in New York City, and now I'm a New York State Governor Advisory Board on aging. Doctor, I'm very impressed for your presentation emphasis on inclusiveness. I'm so moved by your saying you lose your Japanese identity, but you gain Asian American community. It's really role model your presentation. I would just to say is, I myself, I'm not accepting Trump, but I'm not rejecting him. But I was very feel painful when Trump was inaugurated. There's Asian in White House, there's a group, Asian American group. So hard to establish the things, Clinton administration and Bush and, you know, established Asian American Pacific Islander commission in the White House as a bridge from grassroots community to White House. You know, this group, about 15 or 20 commissioners, they protest, they quit, the whole group. I feel so painful. Why couldn't they working with Trump to challenge, to reform, to suggest, recommend on behalf of Asian American community? But they quit. That's very, very belittle self. This is Asian American, you know, in front of a white community. So I'm saying, another point I'm trying to say is, the Asian American, some people, I can tell, doctor, yourself, you on the whole, across the board, you advocate for Asian American organization, a political stronger identity. On the personally, you all practice yourself. But some people leadership in Asian American, they are saying one thing, they are advocate for Asian American community as a whole. But personally, they are not. They are very, very, still that, you know, as I see, you are saying growing together, but growing apart. And there are so many agencies in, Chinatown. And I myself, I'm a board member of CPC, Chinese American Planning Council. I like to work with all agencies. I don't care. As long as they are beneficial to Chinatown development, I'm all for them, help them, and publicize them. But some of them, they work for power struggle. And this is, I feel, very painful. So I hope you can share your experience with us. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Your praise for me may diminish because I was actually one of those commissioners for the president's commission who actually did resign. And in fact, I resigned before there were six of us actually who resigned before the majority of the commission did resign. I resigned, I submitted my resignation to take place on January 20th, 2017 at noon. And the reason is I could not see myself serving and advising this particular president. A misogynist, a batterer, someone who, and it wasn't so much what I thought he felt about Asian Americans, which is important, but this is my broader point. When I announced to my fellow commissioners that I was going to resign, I stated, I don't even care if Trump ends up being Yuri Kochiyama, which he's not, but if he does, I still can't support the guy because of his attitudes for the LGBTQ community, to the disabled community, to immigrants in general, to Muslims and so forth. We have got to see ourselves as joining in concert with those other struggles as well. We shouldn't compartmentalize what we want. So even if he were wonderful on Asian American issues, which he is not, I still couldn't see myself enabling, supporting, normalizing this particular president. I just simply couldn't do it. Now others can, and I know there's a lot of criticism about why not maintain a seat at the table. Well, the question is, what will he do with the commission? He hasn't dispensed with it, but it appears that what he is doing is placing in the position not people who represent, as you pointed out, community advocates, people who represent the people that I'm talking about in the issues. He's looking at people who are interested in trade with Asia and so forth. He is once again probably going to put the office, if it continues to exist, within the Department of Commerce with a business focus on Asia, fundamental misunderstanding of what Asian America is anyway. And so I don't think I'd find a home advising him at all anyway. But it's a legitimate criticism is what I'm saying. It maybe is not the right thing to do. I asked my students on the day that I was going to resign, what should I do? And most of my students said, Paul, you should stay and try to fight within the administration. I can appreciate that view, but I just simply could not advise somebody with that background, with that resume, with those norms and those values. But I'm not critical of those who can't.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much again, Paul Watanabe, for those comments. And it really frames our discussion today. I must say that the comments that were just made causes me to really think. You know, my family is in the United States for six generations now. And I've always carried tremendous hope as each generation continues to live here, to work here, to grow here, to prosper here, and so on. And now I realize that it isn't just hope. What's really necessary is a belief that ultimately the system will yield and allow the changes that need to be made so that that hope can flourish. And some of Paul's comments speak to that. We have to make sure that the system is held accountable so that our hope is not just floating freely. Our hope has to be connected to an understanding that the system will yield, and we have to find ways to make that yield.